Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, an analysis by the Union of Concerned Scientists found contamination by toxic chemicals in groundwater at Dover Air Force Base was dramatically higher than federal health limits recommended this year. Contributor John Hurdle delves into how that contamination occurred and what is or isn't being done about it. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have more on efforts to improve Delaware's family court and examine how the shift to paying healthcare providers based on healthy patient outcomes is working in Delaware so far. Plus, our arts playlist looks at a new series of exhibits coming to the Delaware Contemporary. And this week's Enlighten Me tells us about UD research into hurricane preparedness. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The contamination of groundwater by toxic chemicals is garnering more attention nationally and here in the First State, driven by concern over the link such contamination has to a variety of cancers, thyroid disease, and other health issues. One of the places this issue has bubbled up is Dover Air Force Base, where a new analysis by the Union of Concerned Scientists found levels of toxic PFAS chemicals in groundwater were dramatically higher than federal health limits recommended this year. Just how bad is the problem? How did it happen? And what may be done about it are some of the questions contributor John Hurdle addresses in his latest piece, available now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he learned. So just how serious is the contamination at Dover Air Force Base, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists?
Well, they've recently put out a study showing that the contamination of these so-called PFAS chemicals is actually 254,000 times higher than a proposal for a federal health limit that was made a few months ago. Now, that's a pretty eye-popping number, and we should say that it's based on a comparison that the Union of Concerned Scientists did between the previously published data from the Department of Defense. They did some testing back in the base back in 2016. So UCS compared those data with the health levels that are proposed by a federal agency that I guess many people may not have heard of. It's called the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. And they produced a series of recommendations back in June that were actually 7 to 10 times stricter than the health advisory limits that are proposed by the EPA.
And so just to be clear, as you were saying before, this data is not necessarily new. It's numbers we already knew about?
Yeah, we did already know about the data. What we didn't know about was how it compared with these new federal health limits. And those limits, I should say, I mean, they're only in the form of recommendations at the moment, which is the same as the EPA. But campaigners on this issue are saying that the federal government and state authorities as well should be regulating these chemicals to the ATSDR standard, not to that proposed by the EPA.
And just to put a little context onto this, as a point of comparison, the National Guard Air Base in Newcastle and the Marine Corps Reserve Training Center in Wilmington were also included in this Union of Concerned Scientists analysis. How did they stack up?
Well, they were also significantly above this ATSDR level, not as dramatically as that of the Dover base, but in the case of the Newcastle base, the chemical, the two PFAS chemicals, that is specifically PFOA and PFOS, were found at around about 750 times the ATSDR limit. That's at the Newcastle base. And at the Marine Corps Reserve Training Center at Wilmington, the contamination there was 176 times greater than recommended.
So all this begs the question, how does this happen? Why is the contamination so serious at Dover Air Force Base and some of these other military installations?
Well, the answer is firefighting foam. The military has been using firefighting foam containing these chemicals for years and years, and it has washed down into waterways and contaminated some water systems within the bases themselves, and in some cases contaminated, found its way into public water systems and private water wells off base.
And this is certainly a legitimate cause for concern. As I noted in the intro to this segment, there are some serious health issues that can be caused by this type of contamination in groundwater, right?
Yes, there's a laundry list of very serious illnesses that have been linked to these chemicals. They include kidney cancer, testicular cancer, something called ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, elevated cholesterol, and a number of other issues. And that's why the chemicals are the subject of increasing concern, not only by environmental and public health campaigners, but also by officials in the state and federal governments.
So most people's first thought, John, may be, well, what is the government saying or doing about this, specifically the EPA, who we would expect would be the watchdog or something like this?
Well, indeed. The EPA referred my questions to the Defense Department, and a spokeswoman for the Dover base said that she was unable to answer my questions in the time that we had available. What I will say is it's important to note here that the EPA, even though it's attracted a lot of criticism from campaigners on this issue for not stepping up and regulating the chemicals on a national basis, the EPA is paying attention, and earlier this year did what I think they referred to as a national listening tour of about half a dozen sites in various parts of the country that have a problem with contamination. And what they said shortly before that tour was that they will produce a management plan on the whole issue before the end of this year, and they are looking at whether to regulate those two chemicals, PFOA and PFOS.
But as you note in your piece, environmental groups are worried that the EPA, if it does act, isn't going to act quickly enough. So what are they saying, environmental groups, about what should be done?
Well, as I mentioned, they're saying that that the EPA should pass national standards. They should regulate the chemicals so that water system suppliers, water purveyors, are required to conform to strict limits. And specifically, in the campaigners' view, these limits should be those that have been proposed by the ATSDR. But on the speed of this whole process, what the campaigners are saying is that they're referring to the typically slow pace of federal regulation, so that even if the EPA decides that it does want to regulate some of these chemicals, it's likely going to be years before any of those regulations go on the books and become effective.
How about Delaware state officials? What's their response to this situation?
Denrec says that that these two chemicals are treated as hazardous substances. I've also had a conversation with the health department, and they're watching this, but what they say is that they're not the lead agency on the cleanup at Dover. But what they are saying is that they, like other state agencies, are urging the EPA to regulate the chemicals so that there is one national standard that everybody knows where they stand.
Are there any other states dealing with this that they could offer a model for what Delaware could do in the absence of any stronger federal response?
Well, probably the best example of this right now, recently, is New Jersey. For about the last 4 years, New Jersey's been working on regulating three of the chemicals, and one of them, called PFNA, New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection is in the process. They adopted a final rule on a very strict level of that, much stricter than that being proposed by the EPA. And so that regulation is about to be implemented, and the officials in New Jersey are in the process of considering tough new limits on two other PFAS chemicals. As a result of all this, New Jersey is seen as being a national leader on the issue. In Pennsylvania, just last month, Governor Wolf set up what he called an action team of state officials to study this issue and to recommend ways of managing it in the face of what he said was a failure of federal leadership.
Based on people you've talked to, John, how concerned should people be, both at Dover Air Force Base and the community surrounding about this contamination?
The Delaware Health Department tells me that there was just one private well off base that was found to be contaminated with chemicals above the EPA level. That's when the testing was done in 2016, and that well has been cleaned up with the use of carbon filters, which is a standard way of dealing with these issues. And so they said that there's no reason for anybody to be alarmed, but there is a further round of testing which is due to take, and that is off base, which is due to take place later this year or early 2019.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. His piece on groundwater contamination at the Dover Air Force Base is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, healthcare insurers across the country are shifting away from paying providers for the number of doctor visits or tests performed and towards paying for healthy patient outcomes. Delaware Public Media's Nick Foligno has more on how it's working in Delaware so far. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Healthcare payers across the country are shifting away from paying providers for the number of doctor visits and tests they perform and toward paying for healthy patient outcomes. Delaware Public Media's Nick Foligno has more on a group of primary care practices in the first state that say they've been able to successfully use this payment model to both save money for Medicare and improve their patient outcomes.
Jessica Marker and Linda Darling are meeting each other in person for the first time, but they've known each other over the phone for years. Jessica is a chronic care management nurse at a primary care practice in Milford called the Southern Delaware Medical Group, and Linda is a chronic care patient.
When I'm really concerned, I want to call the doctor's office and talk to Jess. So that's been very helpful for me.
Linda herself is a retired nurse. She is also a diabetic, receiving medical insurance through Medicare. Jess's job is to stay in touch with patients like Linda, making sure they're following up with doctor recommendations and staying out of the emergency room.
I'm here. I encourage them to call me anytime with any questions. I can schedule appointments just as well as I can answer questions. I call, make their specialist appointments for them, follow up, make sure they've gone, look for office notes. I try to collect everything so that we can coordinate the care for the patient.
But this wasn't always Jess's role at Southern Delaware Medical Group. The practice made changes to the way it follows up with patients when it joined an Accountable Care Organization, or ACO. The group it joined was the Delaware branch of the Maryland-based ACO called Allidaid. The group includes 23 Medicare primary care private practices across all three Delaware counties. Through Allidaid, the Southern Delaware Medical Group is now incentivized to save money for Medicare and create positive health outcomes for its patients. So Jessica Marker follows up with patients to try to reduce costly duplicative tests and trips to the emergency room. She schedules annual wellness visits to check the patient's overall health and transitional care management visits to follow up with patients after a hospitalization to try to reduce readmissions.
Before this program, we'd see a patient maybe every 3 to 6 months, where now we're connecting with this patient at least on a monthly basis. Sometimes with these patients, I'm weekly or even daily on the phone with them.
This is commonly called value-based care. Its effectiveness relies both on the work of care managers like Jessica and the use of data to keep track of the patients. Jess and others at Southern Delaware are assisted by the Allidaid app.
I'll show you what it looks like from the very beginning.
That's Sarah Marshall, Allidaid's Delaware Market Coordinator. She shows us that the app keeps track of data previously unavailable to most doctors. It displays all patient diagnoses which factor into the patient's risk score, and it shows all of the patient's Medicare claims, including emergency room visits and visits to specialists.
So that helps with a couple of reasons. It increases visibility so the doctor knows what's going on with the patient, because as we all know, memory is not always the best way to convey information. So this is puts it right there. It also can alert the doctor to if there is something going on that they didn't know about, or if there's something going on that the doctor themselves can help to manage.
Doctors know from the app what medications the patients take so they don't make duplicate prescriptions. They know what vaccines the patients have not received and which specialist the patient is due to visit.
So we're pretty much filling in the blanks and making sure we have complete comprehensive care instead of fragmented care.
That's Dr. Bashara Halu of Georgetown Medical Associates, another member of the Delaware Aledade ACO. He's been practicing in Delaware for just over 21 years and joined Aledade in 2014. He says he got into value-based care hoping to improve the quality of life of his patients while reducing the cost of care. But he says it did not pay off right away.
From a financial part in the beginning, it was not a very good investment, I'll tell you that. It was a big learning curve. The first 6 months in 2014 were just, everybody was just volunteering their time and effort and energy.
Aledade charges a monthly fee to its members, and additional staffing is often required for a practice to get started with Aledade's follow-up initiatives. The practice also needs to keep electronic medical records to use the Aledade app. Some Delaware practices still use pad and paper. And Aledade is the first of Delaware's four ACOs to adopt a two-sided risk contract. So if the ACO saves money for Medicare, it gets to share in the savings. But if it ends up costing more, the ACO pays money back into the system. It wasn't until 2017 Dr. Halu saw a return on his investment.
If you're committed, you're committed. And that's when you have to have a conscientious effort. It's not about the money, it's about the quality of care. But you want to be rewarded for doing a good job.
In 2017, the Delaware Aledade Accountable Care Organization reduced hospitalizations by 13%, saved Medicare more than $5.5 million, and earned a quality score of 96%. And Linda Darling, the diabetes patient at Southern Delaware Medical Group, says she has noticed improvement in her care since the practice adopted a value-based contract. She says her follow-up calls with Jessica Marker helped her manage her medication as she recovered after a heart attack.
Well, that saved me a couple of trips into the doctor, and we were able to manage this part of a chronic issue I'm going to have to live with in a really efficient way that made me feel really supported and that I had somebody I could connect to very quickly.
To start the year, the state of Delaware changed its Medicaid contracts to include value-based incentives, and many of the state's major hospitals have done the same with private insurers. Delaware is also incentivizing private practices with one-time competitive grants to take steps towards shifting to value-based care. Aledade officials say theirs is the only Delaware ACO thus far to receive shared savings with Medicare. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Nick Schellino.
Thanks, Nick. And we have more to come on The Green, including a look at work to improve Delaware's family court. But first, a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney and other state officials got an update on work to improve Delaware's family court this week. The state was awarded a $400,000 federal grant in 2013 to fund its Family Court Enhancement Project. That project aimed to improve the child custody decision-making process in cases involving domestic violence. Claire DeMatteis was among those who worked closely on evaluating what kind of improvements were needed and help implement them. As grant funding for this project ends, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller spoke with the former senior counsel to then-Senator Joe Biden about family court and the improvements made during this enhancement project.
Why did we need the grant? What kind of things were going on at that time?
We needed the grant to be able to spend the dollars to equip the courthouses with video monitors, to produce the materials for litigants who come to court and don't have an attorney, to produce the video that every litigant sees when they come into family court. So the grant money went towards improving the equipment, the signage, and the materials for family court.
Were there issues that needed to be addressed? Is that why the project started?
The Violence Against Women Act was enacted in 1994. So there was this rush of really good reforms. What Family Court of Delaware found was 24 years later, things had gotten stale. They weren't focusing on litigants. So they took a really self-critical look and said, we need to do better. And that's when they applied for the grant. and we're able to get the $400,000 to improve the processes to help people who come to court for protection from abuse orders and child custody orders.
When someone enters family court, can you talk about, like, kind of the process?
So if a person is abused physically, emotionally, verbally by their spouse, by their boyfriend, by their significant other, by their intimate partner, the place they need to go to get a protection from abuse order is family court. And if they are getting a divorce and there's children involved, the place they need to go is family court for that divorce, for child custody, and for child support. It is the critical court for families. And we found in looking at the processes that we needed some additional focus to improve the experience for people who come through family court.
So when they were talking earlier about mediation and going to trial, who decides, how does that work, whether someone goes through mediation or how someone goes to trial?
Everybody has the option to first go through mediation, to sit down with a mediator and see if you can solve your differences, or to see if you can consent to a protection from abuse order. If they don't want to go through mediation, they don't have to. If they first want to try mediation, they can. If they try mediation and it fails, then they go to a judge and they have a trial.
And so when people were talking about cattle calls, can you explain what they mean by that and what have you guys done to improve that situation?
The cattle call reference was that on days when judges and commissioners hear protection from abuse orders, it was like a herd of people. It was like herding cattle into the courthouse, into a courtroom, into mediation, into a trial. There was not enough focus on the fact that these people have trauma, that there's likely domestic violence and physical violence involved, that they have children. So the cattle call was a reference to the fact that it was not welcoming. It was like herding cattle, and it should be a much more important experience than just feeling like you're herding cattle.
So what have you guys done to change that?
When you come into the courthouse now, there's signs everywhere pointing you to where you need to go, where you need to check in. Signs in various languages, not just English. The people that you encounter have name tags, so you know that if they're court staff or their attorney or if they're advocates. So we've made it more welcoming. When you go into our resource centers, there's materials, one page that explains what is child custody, who can file for a PFA. So we've improved the materials for people who come into the courthouse so that they feel more welcome, that it's not like you're herding them one place, you're actually having people show them where to go. And then when they get into the courtroom, there's a commissioner that gives you specific information on what the day is going to be like. If you want a trial, how you go to trial, it's explained much more intimately. It's explained in much more easier terms so that people can understand it better.
That's another thing I didn't understand. Why are some people called commissioners and some people called judges?
It's a good question. Commissioners are not full judges. Commissioners don't have the authority of judges, but judges' caseloads are so overwhelming that the General Assembly created a position called a commissioner, and they hear cases earlier in the process, and they hear more simpler cases that they can handle, and the more complex issues go to the judge.
If a commissioner hears a case and you don't like the outcome, can you appeal it to a judge?
No, a commissioner doesn't have something that they decide that can be appealed. It would then go to a judge. It's not appealed. It's just the next step is to go to a judge. So a protection from abuse order is issued by a commissioner, and they have the authority to issue that. A commissioner cannot rule on child custody. Only a judge can.
Then what can a commissioner do?
A commissioner can hear more simpler cases and creates a record for the judge. So you heard now that commissioners create a record of domestic violence. It then goes to a judge who may hear the final protection from abuse order or will hear the child custody case. So the commissioner helps create the record that then goes to the judge, so the judge has more information when they're deciding a case.
Okay. But they don't make a decision on the protective order or custody or anything.
The commissioner can issue a protection from abuse order after a hearing. Yes, a commissioner can do that. Yes. A commissioner does not rule on child custody. Only a judge can.
So when it comes to custody and divorce and stuff like that, does the grant have anything that it did in that particular area?
The grant specifically dealt with protection from abuse orders and child custody cases that have domestic violence in the household. It had nothing to do with divorce.
So the grant ends
October 31st.
So going forward, is there anything going forward that you guys are going to be doing? I heard there were some rule changes that were happening.
So there has been rule changes. They are embedded now in the court process. They will remain the same. And the court has hired a domestic violence coordinator, one person who will help keep this progress moving forward, and one person who will coordinate domestic violence cases, whether they're in family court, court of common pleas, superior court. You may have a litigant who has a case in family court that involves domestic violence and a superior court case. And that superior court judge should know the record, should know the history. So this person will help coordinate it and take it to the next stage to better have a better experience for litigants throughout the court system.
Thanks to Claire DeMattias and our Sarah Mueller for their time this week. The Green continues in a moment with our latest arts playlist and a look at a new series of exhibitions coming to the Delaware Contemporary in 2019. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Contemporary is introducing a new concept at its Wilmington Riverfront home. It's called the Draper Experiment, and it invites artists to creatively respond to contemporary issues using the E. Avery Draper Gallery at the heart of the Delaware Contemporary space. The Draper Experiment accepted proposals from artists reflecting their concerns and critiques of the world around them and encouraged use of new methods and techniques. The first round of Draper Experiment exhibits are scheduled for 2019, and in this week's arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Catherine Page, the Gretchen Hupfel Curator of Contemporary Art at the Delaware Contemporary, about what to expect from these exhibits.
What is the Draper Experiment?
The Draper Experiment is an idea that surfaced during one of many of our department's meeting. We were trying to come up with an innovative way to generate more opportunities for artists. And we thought for the 2019 season, let's offer Draper Experiment. That idea actually is the love child of our former curatorial associate who's now moved to Florida. And he thought we should call it Draper Experiment to push the idea of experimentation to expand the territory of materiality and space, not just push the boundaries, but truly exploit the avant-garde. And so we put out a call to artists to submit proposals, and there were six slots, and so we chose six artists or six teams of collaborators who exemplified to us the idea of truly experimentation with the materials at hand. And so in this way, we can offer the most contemporary art expression, something that is truly engaging, that is visually arresting for the viewer, as well as contemplation and promoting a modicum of internal reflection as well.
Was it hard to whittle it down to these six or seven? You must have gotten lots of people interested in this.
We got lots of people, and it was extremely difficult because the team, the curatorial team, they wrestled with trying to whittle it down to six, which ones really did embody the concept. which ones actually had the most persuasive proposal, aesthetically as well as written. It was important for us, for those artists, to really state their case. And so not only with word, but with vision.
All right, Catherine, let's go through the six artists chosen and their exhibits, and let's tell people about each one of them.
The first person on the docket is Willie Yao, and he is a Chinese national, and he is teaming with number 223, who is a famous artist in China, and together their work will display concepts of identity, a concept of relationship, concept of transplanting oneself to a new place in time, and then wrestling with what it means to assimilate in society. So each artist or team, they have about 8 weeks where their work will be on display in the Draper, the E. Avery Draper Gallery. And the Draper Gallery, I should say, is it rests right in the cockles of the museum. It's surrounded by all the main galleries, and right in the epicenter is this Draper experiment. So it really does have a unique setting, and it's right next to an annex space as well, so there's room for all kinds of experimentation. Willie Yao will have two-dimensional work, and number 223 will have photographs.
All right, so besides Willie, move on to the second artist.
The next artist is Tia Santana. Tia Santana is known for her ceramic vessels, and those vessels, the construction of those, are wholly informed by her identity, and her identity rests in her hair. She's African-American artist, and so she uses what is so profoundly gorgeous on her, it's her hair. And so she takes the notion of coils of her own hair and transposes that into the three-dimensional clay. And so she will form coils in clay and wrap them around and incorporate her own hair into the pieces.
Oh, wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Catherine, talk a little bit about Anthony Bowers.
Anthony Bowers is our third installment of the Draper Experiment. His exhibition called Hopes and Dreams, Fears and Feels. It explores issues around consumerism and waste. And what he does is he takes familiar materials and then reconfigures them and then arranges these completely disparate objects such that the viewers consider the trappings and subliminal displays of class. And to heighten the tension in his installations, Bowers needs Western, oftentimes Western ecclesiastical processes such as confession and prayer to alleviate fear and anxiety. So we're looking forward to that one.
All right, what about Clay Dunklin?
That's the fourth installment. The title of his exhibition is Song of the Wild. He subverts the space of the gallery and its navigational methods. His jarring site-specific installations, they examine ideas around the body and its relationship to time and technology as a way of exploring how we negotiate the space between reality and the self. And he intends to create these wax vessels fabricated from his own skull installed on the floor of the gallery. And so with careful spotlighting, those vessels then create this otherworldly precinct. So that should be exciting.
All right. What about Chris Andricola and Jake Foster?
Right. That's the fifth one. And the title to their exhibition is called Domestic Disturbance. What they do is they have teamed up to generate a series of photographs. And those photographs investigate the ways mass media and consumeristic lifestyles disconnect social ties, resulting in disconnection with humanity and nature and repressed sexuality. And they plan to arrange the photographs to create a disruption of domestic reality in order to critique modern life.
And finally, we have Jacintha Clark.
Yes, our last one. Thresholds of Memory is the title she has given us. And what she does is challenge the limits of the ability of porcelain to contain memory and time by reconfiguring its materiality and physical form. Porcelain is very difficult to throw on the wheel, and so it has a life on its own. And so it's often, her work is often referred to as three-dimensional drawings with clay. What she does is those objects register the past and present, or oftentimes they'll coin American idioms. And so she uses the clay to replicate familiar commodities into new concepts. One installation she calls Pack Lightly. And what she did was she created packaging peanuts out of porcelain and stuffed them in a box. So what she does is upend that ubiquitous shipping object designed to cushion fragile items with vastly fragile material. So I look forward to what she's going to present.
All right. So all of these artists we've been talking about are part of the Draper Experiment 2019. Did we leave anything else out that you want people to know about the Draper Experiment?
The Draper Experiment was an idea for us to come up with something unusual and provocative in a way to engage artists. And some of the artists, it's a solo, and other exhibitions, it's a collaboration, yet it's a one product. And so we're excited to see what each of these artists will be bringing to the gallery space.
Thanks to the Delaware Contemporary's Catherine Page and our Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist. We put information about each artist in the Draper Experiment up on our website, DelawarePublic.org, along with the dates their works will be on display. And stay with us. In a week that saw Hurricane Michael slam into the Florida panhandle, Enlighten Me is next with a timely look at the UD Disaster Research Center's work on hurricane preparedness. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, Hurricane Michael quickly intensified and slammed into the Florida panhandle, putting that state's hurricane readiness to the test. Readiness for storms like Michael is one area the University of Delaware's Disaster Research Center examines in depth, and the center is part of a larger group recently awarded nearly $2 million to specifically study the factors that influence whether people prepare for hurricanes. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt has more in this week's Enlighten Me.
Scientists agree the United States will face more and more intense storms in coming years, but it isn't clear what's the best way to help communities prepare for storms. A National Science Foundation grant of almost $2 million is going to Jamie Cruz of East Carolina University, Cornell University's Linda Nozick, and Rachel Davidson and Joseph Trainer at University of Delaware to help answer that question. Joe Trainer is an associate professor of public policy and administration and a core faculty member at UD's Disaster Research Center.
If we boil it down, the real question is, what drives communities to be more safe or less safe? And for a long time, we've been looking at disaster-specific interventions, doing things like raising homes or things like storm shutters or strengthening windows. So the idea is we've got houses out there and we're trying to incentivize people to make those houses stronger. One of the problems with focusing on the issue that way is that you're already looking at the problems.
And that's
that
all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app.
Because of the environment,
we'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org.
Is it's trying
Thanks
to look
all those
at
who helped make today's show possible. Contributor John Hurdle,
so we're
Delaware
not
Public
just
Media's Nick Shalino, Sarah
Muir, on the problems,
Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele.
We are looking at those
for all of them. And the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week,
kind of,
and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.
Political drivers, but mostly the development drivers, are pushing people to develop in these ways.
I noticed that the research team, people are coming from different fields. So do you want to talk about the interdisciplinary nature of this research project?
Sure. That's actually one of the most exciting elements of this project. And the reason is in universities across history, we've built up these little silos, right? We've built up these little kind of areas of expertise, and a lot of times people only work within those areas of expertise. So what this project has done, and one of the things that, the National Science Foundation has been doing generally over the last couple of years, is incentivizing teams to get together and think about big problems in communities, big problems in our nation, and try to bring people that have different views and perspectives and expertise on those problems together. So that's what we did in this particular project. So I've been working with the folks on this team for quite some time now on other projects. So we have an engineer who's also here at the University of Delaware, Dr. Davidson, who is a specialist in engineering risk analysis. We have an economist, Dr. Cruz, who is focuses on economics generally, but economics associated with disaster. And then we have another engineer on our team who focuses primarily on math modeling. That is Linda Nozick. Dr. Nozick focuses on basically taking the inputs and the data and turning it into a representation of the world. Obviously, it doesn't get as complicated as the real world is, but we're trying to represent the real world in important ways.
What is the product of this research, and how are you hoping that people and governments can use it?
So what we envision here basically is a tool that could be used by the professionals in emergency management. So sometimes we talk about those professionals, they're called mitigation specialists. So those are the folks that focus on this kind of risk reduction. They could either be local government or county government or state government or even at the federal government level. The idea is a tool that those folks could use to look at different options that they might put together and see which ones are going to reduce the most risk for the least amount of cost or the least amount of disruption to the communities. And that's especially important because a lot of the things that are being done now, they only think about one stakeholder group. So it's either it might be businesses, or it might be insurance companies, or it might be how can we improve what government is doing, or how can we improve what homeowners are doing. And what we're trying to do with our model is find solutions that actually cut across those different groups. What we're hoping for is a tool where someone would sit down at a computer, or they would sit down at an interface, and they would be looking at their community, and they might input a little bit of data from their community, or they might select, you know, click a button and say, "Well, I want to imagine my community had this characteristic." Some of those fields might be something like, "How much money do you guys have to spend? What is the economic breakdown of people in your community?" Or, "What are the characteristics of your housing stock? Is it wood frame? Is it what type of roofs do they typically have?" So you would input data about the kinds of storms that have happened in the past or things that we think might be possible in the future. And then we would have a list of options. You know, what if I gave an incentive? What if I gave a grant? What if I used low interest loans? What if I, you know, also could be land use. It could be something like incentivizing people to buy storm shutters, for example, in a hurricane area. Or it could be looking at the way that insurance companies operate, for example, and incentivizing insurance companies to reduce premiums. We are going to try to use real-life solutions, things that people are either considering or thinking about for the future, and we're going to try to understand which of those are likely to perform the best. One of the first things we're actually going to do with this project is we're going to convene a meeting of experts in the area, and we're going to bring in practitioners, people who are really working in positions where they make these kinds of decisions, to have a conversation about what these incentives are. So those experts could be folks from the universities. They could be folks in mitigation departments. They could be folks in planning and zoning departments. They could be folks from economic development. We're trying to look pretty broadly. We're trying to cast a wide net because we believe, just like it was better for us to get a bigger team of experts and that had a lot of different perspectives, when we're looking at the solutions, we need to look across different stakeholders in society or different groups in our communities to get the set of ideas.
It sounds like there's a lot of, in at least that list, and maybe that wasn't the full list, policymakers or the thinkers, and less so maybe people who have like tried boarding up their homes or like the builders you were mentioning. So is that going to be part of it?
We are doing the initial meetings with experts to help think about the range of possibilities. And then the second round of data collection, actually, it will be surveys with the public. So the idea is if we get this set of ideas from risk experts that they either are implementing or may implement in the future, then we take those ideas to the public through surveys and we ask them, what if we did this? Would you think about this? Would you consider it? Would you not consider it? You know, what if the pricing looked like this? What if it looked like that? And then the responses to those surveys make the basis for are the basis for building the math models, for building the engineering risk models, for building the economic models, along with other kinds of data.
What is the term of the grant, and or can you give me a sense for like timeline when people could expect a usable tool?
Sure. So this particular grant is a 5-year grant. So we are actually at the very, very beginning of the project. It'll evolve over time, I guess. So there is actually a working prototype already. It is mostly the math models themselves. We are actively kind of looking, though, at how to move forward and develop the actual tool. So I think what you're likely to see in the short term are interim kinds of tools, test kinds of material that we would work with communities. We'll develop a version of this that works in a smaller communities, for example. This grant alone will not produce the street-ready tool, but it's a necessary first investment in order to get that tool ready.
It's kind of a big question, and it seems obvious, but I'd just kind of like to hear you talk a bit about why something like this is necessary. What are we going through now? What can we expect to go through? What's the whole impetus for your research?
So I've been studying hazards and disasters for quite some time, and one of the things that we see in the data is this problem is not going away. We're seeing more hazards, more disasters. We're seeing large catastrophes, and we're seeing them both in the developed world and in the developing world. We're seeing major events on a year-to-year basis. So part of the issue is, part of the question we have to stop and ask ourselves after a while is if we keep getting impacted by these events and we keep seeing them come through and we keep losing money and we keep losing buildings and we keep losing people, it's on us as society, it's on us as communities to stop and think about how we're building, to stop and think about how we are interacting with the natural world around us, and to ask ourselves, are we doing it in the smartest way possible? Are we doing things to make people within communities safe? And I think, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time as a social scientist actually doing interviews and collecting data both face-to-face and in these surveys from people who have experienced these events. And if you spend a little time with folks who've had to live through this, it really puts a mark on you, right? If you spend a little time with talking to folks who've had these disasters affect their life, you know that it means something, you know that it's important, and you know that it provides a lot of motivation to do what you can to try to keep other people from that kind of suffering.
Thanks to the UD Disaster Research Center's Joe Trainer and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino, Sarah Mueller, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.